it's not good politically for you. But see, so there's something about our culture that likes to ignore the data and ignore the science, and that has bad consequences. For example, in Holland, where I was raised, which became a very nice country after I left, the incarceration rate right now is 68 per 100,000 people, because the Ministry of Health pays attention to what we know about child abuse and family support. In America, it's 980 per 100,000 people. So you either pay by knowing the science and you pay up front to help people, or you pay later on in unemployment, crime, drug addiction, etc., etc. But you pay. And so it's sort of useful to know the science. So here, Carlin, my friend, is dealing with these lonely moms and their kids. And then she looks around, finds out, what is the most helpful thing that we can do? And she comes across what turns out the single most effective mental health intervention known to mankind, which is helping young mothers physically to raise their children, to be there, to help them, to give them actual assistance, to go to their homes, help them to cook meals, show them how to hold their babies, and actively do the stuff. And she does that. And after 6 months, these kids are much better than they were before. So if you help the parents, and normalize the parents, and therefore the parents, the kids start being better. The next thing that happens is something that's happened to every single one of us with a regularity that continues to stun me. It's happened to me just again. Is when you do a good piece of work in the area of trauma, suddenly your funding gets cut. Recently, $2.5 million of my funding was stolen. Happened to Carlin, happens to Frank Putnam, happens to all of us. There is something in our society that really hates people who do this work. So Carlin's funding gets cut. And so she has a little bit of money left. She cannot complete her study. She has a little bit of money, and with that money she treats one third of her sample for another year. And after another year, these kids do almost as well as the kids in the community. And then the study comes to an end because nobody is studying the issue of child abuse, because it doesn't exist. Only one out of 100 million women has child abuse. It's off the map. And then 14 years later, the priest abuse scandal starts in Boston. The priest abuse scandal who gave us the vote in Ireland yesterday, and at the end, America made Europe a much better place. People in Europe see how crazy our society has become, and they use us as an example. Let's not become like America. So the Irish yesterday legalized abortion after all that stuff. Maybe not all of you are in favor of that, but I certainly think that women being in charge of their own bodies seems like a pretty good idea to me, actually. So, it's all this politics always comes in. But before I tell you about what happens next, I want to describe what Carlin notices, and it's a very important issue. She makes videotapes, and she never gave me her videotapes, because they're confidential, of course, but I can describe the videotapes. And the videotapes are how moms and kids interact. So, at age 2, kids sitting on the floor playing with toys. Mom comes in the room. You see mom sort of eager to make a good impression on the researchers. So mom parts over. Kid smiles at mom. Mom picks the little kid up. And if you look really carefully, but you have to, it's not easy to see, you see the kid just going back a little bit as if to say, hey mom, this is about you, it's not about me. I was playing. Can you be a little bit more attentive to me? But it's not easy to see. Many people would miss it. 6 months later, same mom, same kid. Mom comes to the room. Baby looks up. Baby smiles, and baby looks away. Mom picks the kid up, and the kid is sort of not responding to the mom. And you say, something has happened. 6 months later, mom comes to the room. Baby sitting on the floor. Baby looks up, falls on the floor, gets paralyzed. Mom picks the baby up, and baby goes like this. They say, "Oh my God, something happened here." And that's an issue of attunement. Where we started off yesterday, we started off this morning, is the attunement between organisms. And somehow this kid has come to experience its mom as a potentially dangerous person. And that, of course, is a setup for disaster, because every mom likes to love their kid, and every mom likes to be a good mother. But if you are chronically out of tune with your kid starts being hostile and difficult. And there's another attachment researcher who shows me a different tape at one point. Her name is Beatrice Beebe. All right. Yes? No? That's good. Okay, good. So, you know, I'm going to talk about the brain a little bit, but I first would like to show you some other things. But clearly, we grew up in this meaning-making, talking, post-alcoholic world. And what it's very clear is that in order to make people's bodies feel safe and our minds clear, we need to do things that are very different. And so that's been the exciting part of this work for me, is the exploration of how can you get people from here to there. And many of the questions that you've asked me are questions where I go like, I try to address some of them in my book, but it's a journey of discovery. So when you ask me, what is the best thing that I can do? I'd say, read my book and underline the stuff that means something to you. And if it resonates with you, try to find somebody who can do it. Because it's not prescriptive. I cannot say, that happened to you, do that. Or just try that and everything will work. This is really all about exploration. And a good example of that is, I hope this is going to work. Yes, it is. Is that about 10 years ago now, we have this trauma center. We had this trauma center, just killed, actually, so sad. We have a very good group of people working together, and we do research on everything that comes along. And an interesting thing happens, again, having to do with the social-political background. Our clinic is in Brookline, Massachusetts. And some of you may know about Brookline. Brookline is a well-to-do professional part of Boston. It's actually a separate town, but it's in the middle of Boston. And that's where our clinic is. And something happens socially that had a big impact on our clinic, namely that we have a fair number of gay people, gay couples living in our community. And Massachusetts was the first state that legalized gay marriage. And little did I anticipate that gay people, because I'm not gay, I have some gay friends, didn't think much about it, that when people get married, they want to have kids. And suddenly all these gay people in Brookline start adopting kids. And they were all generally well-to-do, very conscious people. And they thought, mistakenly, that we are a loving couple, and we are going to take these deprived, abused, neglected kids into our home, and by taking them in, we go to show them what love and caring is like, and before too long, they'll become just as wonderful as we are. What they did not learn was what we learned from Harry Harlow, more than anybody else, namely that us primates have critical periods of brain development, and that we need to have a certain amount of input into our brain in order to trigger certain neuronal connections to come online. And if at some critical period of your life you do not get to drink the milk of human kindness, you may not get receptors for the milk of human kindness, and human kindness may not do it for you. And so It's been a very hard road for many people who adopt kids from orphanages in Russia and China, is that these kids don't respond to all the stuff that ordinary kids would respond to. And of course, that also happens in America, but it's easier to talk about adopting kids from other countries, which is always a curious issue. And so we get to see a fair number of these kids, and then our job is to find out how to help them. So this story starts with a four-year-old girl who was adopted from China, and who was adopted age 1.5, and she has been mute ever since she was adopted. She doesn't talk. And the parents bring her to us, and you say, I'm sure we can help you. We are really smart. We really know all kind of stuff. Not to worry. 6 months later, the kid is still mute. And we start scratching our heads and say, oh, damn, we don't know how to do this. But we're also somewhat modest people and say, there must be other people who know more than we do. And one of our team says, there's this group of occupational therapists in Watertown who do sensory integration. And let's send her over there and maybe they can do something. And in sensory integration therapy, you have kids walk on balance beams and lie under heavy blankets and sit on swings. And you basically work with the system in the brain that's of great interest to me, very important topic at our conference that will be held this week, the cerebellar vestibular system, the balancing and focusing system of the brain. And this little girl goes through all this weird stuff and she starts talking. And that's really music to my ears. It's interesting. So you deal with balance and about movement and direction, and suddenly your speech center of the brain comes online. Isn't that interesting? So you tweak something over here, and something gets expressed over here. And so we discuss our cases, and Liz Warner, a typical woman of our generation, has a PhD, she drops out of the professional school to raise her kids. After 20 years, she comes back to work. And she says, oh, when I was a young professional, I used to work with autistic kids and we did sensory integration with them. Should we set up a sensory integration clinic in our place? And I say, absolutely, let's go for it. And so, as you can see, we're a very wealthy clinic with very fancy equipment. We're actually a Medicaid clinic. And we buy $300 worth of equipment, and we set up our own sensory integration room. And one of the first things we discover is that when kids, these out-of-control kids who are all over the place and angry and shut down and out of it, when they jump up and down trampolines, they start talking about yesterday and tomorrow. The issue of time is very critical, because when you're traumatized, you live in a timeless piece of misery. When you live in your trauma, you don't know that this too will come to an end. Maybe tomorrow it will be a different day. You get to live, it feels like a timeless thing. And we know what happens in the brain has to do something with part of the brain over here, the timekeeper called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And so our kids live, when you're traumatized, you live in this timeless misery. And when we have kids jump up and down on trampolines, they start talking about yesterday and tomorrow. And I go, that is fascinating, because that's this little part of your brain that you tweak, and now this other part of your brain that allows you to know about time starts coming online, and you get a sense of me in a sausage of time, which is, of course, essential, because if you, let's say right now, you probably sort of enjoy what I'm talking about, but only because you know that this will come to an end. If I would say to you, I'm going to talk and to help with you guys, I'm decided to cancel my airplane, and I'm going to talk and I can talk for a long time. I have another 560 slides to go. I'll probably finish sometime in the wee hours of the morning or beyond. This place turns into hell. So everything is good because you know that it will come to an end. When you live in trauma, it is timeless. So that issue of time is terribly important. And so when people jump up and down on trampolines, the sense of time comes online. That's interesting. So here's a kid who's completely off the wall, and he starts being reasonable, and he's in our sensory integration room. He's 8 years old, and he's a terror in school, doesn't learn, and we always have been looking for his trauma. And so there's yak, 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 all sort of unimportant, but I'm very much into synchrony. And, you know, giving a lot of talks, I'm always impressed, which something you probably are not aware of, is that we tend to move together. Talking to people is very much like talking to a shoal of fish. You don't know that you're just a shoal of fish. But when the person next to you goes like this, you're likely to go like that also. We sort of unconsciously imitate each other. It's very unusual when I give a talk to people to see anybody make a movement that's completely out of sync with people around them. Well, you don't pay attention to that, but that's how it is. Huh? And so what I see is I look at this, that the mom of this kid is making a body movement that is out of sync whatever else is happening. That's unusual. And then she says, he's goofy. So and she says he's goofy. What she says is out of sync with the rest of the conversation. And, you know, I'm a body-oriented person, a rhythm-oriented person. So this mom of this kid is out of sync with whatever is going on, and the movements she makes with her body and what she says is out of sync, very much like that opening tape that I showed you last night of this veteran who is completely out of sync with the people in the supermarket. And it gets worse. Anybody notice what just happened? What? Do you know what happened to... She said, I had a rough week too, and the boy throws himself on the floor. That means something. That means that this boy probably lives in a culture where there is room for only one person. And when mom takes over, there is no room for me. And I start understanding maybe why this boy makes repeated suicide attempts, because if there's no room for you, you may as well kill yourself. And maybe the issue is not who put what into what orifice, but the fact that there is no room for me here. And you'll see this being played out in more detail in a moment. Liz is still old-fashioned therapist here. Yeah.